Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 63, recorded August 1st, 2012. Jeffrey Zeldman.
Background, I was a journalist. I got fired from the Washington Post. I never found out why. I was a musician, but I was getting too old. I mean, we would be touring southern towns, and our hotel, we had a communist for a manager, which, not a joke, he really was a communist, and it turns out they don't make good band managers.
You know, let's give that money back. Those people seem to need it more than you do.
Yeah, pretty much. And so hotel would fall through. We'd be begging for a room to stay in on the, from the stage. I thought, I'm too old for this. Yeah. So I had a lot of background, but I ended up in advertising because the internet hadn't been invented. And if you're a, you know, kind of a creative person, but you're not sure what you're going to do when you grow up and you failed at a couple of things, advertising, it was a place. Anyway, it was a thing.
It's a job. Let's say that we've already begun the show, shall we? Were you recording all that?
Yes.
Because that was really good. If you're just tuning in, this is Jeffrey Zeldman, who has a little bit of a handicap. He has a master's degree in fiction writing and a bachelor's degree in English, which means he has no skills.
How do you know this? I mean, that's true, but how do you know this?
Research, my friend, research. But I first became aware of you literally in 1998 with A List Apart. And I have subscribed and been a follower of A List Apart since 1998. Good and it's Lord. So good to have you on here. I follow you on Twitter. This is the amazing thing about modern social media is I could follow somebody like you and you have no idea I'm stalking you.
Wow, that's very cool. I do that as well. Yeah.
No one knows.
That's another show, though, I think.
It's for another show, yeah.
Yeah.
So, written, I kind of think one of the classic works on web design called Designing with Web Standards, which God knows we need.
Thank you.
And that has, that's been around for some time, right?
Yeah, it's a third edition. The third edition, I asked Ethan Marcotte to help me because he's a brilliant young guy, and he's the guy who pioneered responsive web design and things like that, and I just wanted to really broaden it out and, you know, catch up with where we are. It's a really interesting time as far as that stuff goes.
No kidding.
Yeah, with mobile and everything.
Yeah. You did Dan Cederholm's book. We've interviewed Dan, and the CSS for Web Designers is incredible. You've actually been publishing Aaron Cassani's book.
Yeah.
So let's go back. So we started the interview a little prematurely. You were saying you were a musician, and you decided you didn't want to tour.
I was in the Insect Surfers, and we were...
Oh, I like the name.
Isn't that a great name? It wasn't my name. I came in late. I replaced... a bunch of people quit, and I was one of the replacements. It was a really great band, but I was a little too old to still be doing that. So, and I was writing for the Washington Post, and I got fired. Ugh. And so I ended up in advertising. And I moved to New York because that was the place to go for advertising back then. And, a lot of reasons. New York was a very different place then, and it was the kind of messy, dangerous place that I thought I wanted to live. Now I'm much more conservative, and so is the city, and I'm perfectly happy with that. But
it's grown up with you.
It's grown up with me. It quit smoking, I quit smoking, like all that stuff, right?
Yeah, that's a good point, you know? Yeah. So, how long were you in advertising?
About 10 years.
Good Lord, man.
Well, I learned a lot about, you know, client services, learning the client's business, you know.
Did you do creative?
Yeah. I was a copywriter and art director.
Wow.
And got to work on some really interesting stuff.
And, of course, I guess as we got into the mid-90s and then the late 90s, the thing that everybody wanted to understand better was how is this internet and the web in particular going to change what we do?
So in 1995, I was at an entertainment agency, right? And Because I thought, you know, if you can make a brilliant commercial for dishwashing liquid, how much more interesting would it be if you've got like a musician or a film or a great book or something like that? Like to make commercials for that kind of stuff would be more interesting. Turned out it wasn't. They were actually, they like, you know, making a, an ad for a movie means you put the actors' heads on a billboard.
Yeah.
Right. But I didn't know. Anyway, Warner Brothers was a very interesting client of ours, and Don Buckley was the marketing director in their New York office, and he said, do you guys know how to, we're doing this movie about Batman, and we think there should be a website. Do you guys know how to make a website? And the agency president, Len Foggie, lied and said, sure we do. And then he came and got three guys. I was one of the guys, and said, do you guys know how to make a website? And we said, sure we do. And, you know, and there actually wasn't that much to know back then. Like, there was HTML and Perl.
Yeah, it was all it was CGI at the time. You didn't have PHP. You didn't have, everything ran in a separate CGI directory.
We actually hired someone to do the Perl, and, you know, we learned HTML.
Right.
And we did an animation of the, before, the, there was no Flash or anything, but we didn't know any better, and we wanted to make it exciting, so we took an image of the bat, right, and yeah. we made it smaller and smaller and smaller. Then we did that in reverse, so it looked like it was coming toward you. And we used Perl to modulate between these still images, and so it was like before there were animated GIFs, we made this animated bat coming toward you. And
wow.
There were 3 million people using the web, and we had 1.5 million visitors, and that's what I wanted to do.
That's exciting. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, and it's perfect because you had this kind of mix of skills that in a normal world might not have been, you know, you wouldn't have been able to synthesize, but the web made the perfect place to synthesize the visual, the writing, the creativity, the client service, the whole thing.
And code.
And code.
Right. Right. That was the new part for me, but like right. all that stuff.
Right.
There's a lot of generalists behind a lot of the most interesting web and internet projects, I think.
You've been called the king of web standards, probably because of the book, but also I think you champion this stuff.
I was definitely not the only person who did that.
No.
Yeah, but that label's kind of nice.
Sure.
I like that.
Sure. Did that come from a practical need, or was it a political issue?
It's absolutely practical. It was absolutely practical. Netscape 4 came out, and it was incompatible with Netscape 3, incompatible with IE4, incompatible with IE3. And at that time, 25% at least of the client's budget went to just making incompatible, different proprietary versions
Horrible.
Of the same crap. Right?
Horrible.
And very limited. And when we started the Web Standards Project, we would approach some of the people who I really expected would support us were against us. They said, well, you know how much money I make knowing the five ways to
right.
code a site? And we said, you know, you could take that same money and hire a photographer or a proofreader. How about that? Like, you could spend that extra money making the content better. That made sense to us, and eventually that prevailed. It took a long time. Google helped in a strange way.
How so?
Right. Well, one of the things that we were excited about with was Tim Berners-Lee's vision of the web, that it would be accessible to all. That was one of the things we said early on.
This and is for everyone. He tweeted
this is for
at
everyone.
The Olympics,
and it turned out that businesses didn't really care about that. And if you said, well, you know. People's impression was, well, maybe some blind guy won't see our website, but we don't really care.
Who cares?
That was,
yeah.
Right, we don't care. But then when Google rose to prominence and turned out to be the biggest blind user on the web, when Google said, well, you know, if you use semantic markup, they didn't say this. We figured it out and told people. But it turned out if your most important words were in your H1 headline and the next most important keywords were in your H2 and all that, people would find your content. And if you just put everything in a bunch of divs or a bunch of table cells, it astronomically lowered your findability.
Or heaven forfend in a Flash file.
Right. I think that really hurt Flash.
Oh, yeah.
And there are certainly ways of making Flash content accessible. And there were people like Andrew Kirkpatrick, who really who was at WGBH and then at Adobe, who really worked hard to make that happen. But, you know, it just makes more HTML just makes more sense for that stuff, right? Putting some words inside a tag and making sure that that tag is, you know, that a search engine understands that tag is important. Like, that's kind of the simplest way of getting your content in front of people.
And you became, you're kind of a proponent of the semantic web, CSS. You really helped popularize that, you and Dan, and the Zen Garden.
CSS Zen Garden was great.
Oh, I love that site.
I think a lot of people didn't get it until then. I mean, when I, designing with web standards almost didn't happen, right? Because to me, we'd done the web standards project. The browser makers had said, okay, we win. You win. We'll put standards in our browsers. They were really working. There were people like Tontik Celik, who used to work for IE5 Mac, who were really, you know, they were just as committed to web standards as we were. So that had happened. And when Michael Nolan from New Writers approached me and said, you ought to write a book about this, I said, oh, everybody knows about this. He said, no, they don't. You know, I don't know about you, but when you start publishing on the web, I had an inflated sense of how many people were reading and paying attention.
Everybody read it. Well, everybody who mattered read A List Apart. That's
everybody who mattered, right? So everybody knows. And he said, no, everybody doesn't. And he was right. And the book was very influential. And so that helped. Geez, what was your question?
Well, just the rise of CSS, which you've kind of talked about
right.
a little bit.
Right.
But
okay,
also, and maybe we should define the semantic web.
Okay.
Because that's a term people hear a lot. I can't do it. I don't know. What is it? You should know. Don't you know?
It means different things to different people. And there's some stuff that's kind of bullshit. Can I say?
Yeah.
I don't know.
You said it just right. The right way to say it.
Okay. There's stuff that's not so important or that's kind of theoretical.
Yeah.
But we...
But the notion...
For me, it's practical, right? The notion that if you have... Here's a simple explanation. If you have a paragraph, put it in a paragraph tag. If you have a list, use HTML for lists. If you have a headline, use HTML for headlines. That's very baby-ish way of saying it, but it actually makes sense. It affects... It makes stuff navigable to people with disabilities. It makes people who navigate the web using older technology can still see your page's structure, right? They can see that a headline is bigger
right.
than your text. It does, and search engines read the H1s first, then they read the H2s. That's the same thing that the software that blind people use does. So.
Right.
All those benefits. But what I wanted to say, I had lost my train of thought, but what I wanted to say was the CSS Zen Garden was brilliant because there were still a lot of people who didn't read the book, Designing with Web Standards, and there were still a lot of people who, after reading the book, and there were definitely people who got turned on, but there were a lot of people who, I mean, Flash seemed so much ahead
right.
of anything we could do with HTML. Most of the designers I know who were really talented were you doing stuff in Flash. It just seemed much more advanced. And the CSS Zen Garden was the first time, Dave Shea's creation was the first time, to me, someone said, let's take the content, usually the content that comes from the client, and separate it completely from the visual presentation. Designers, you can do anything. We can take these same words, the same HTML. You know how you're constantly rebuilding pages just because a word changed or because the navigation changed? Look at this. You can make it look like anything. Dave Shea's CSS Zen Garden really made designers realize that CSS was very powerful and that the separation of presentation from structure, the thing we've been talking about in the Web Standards Project and in the Web Standards Movement, that was powerful for designers, that was empowering, not just for clients, but for designers. And I think I can't underestimate how important that was to getting people to buy in to web standards.
It's still there, and if folks want to see, kind of get an idea of how the separation of content and design can make such a difference, this is the default page when you go to csszengarden.com, and then you can apply a design, the same content, but you'd apply a design, and it looks completely different. And this is the beauty of CSS, is that you can do this and without changing any of the underlying content. And I remember what a revelation it was to see this.
Yeah.
And it's still a fun place to go just to mess with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing. So
and before Dribbble, it was also a good way to find designers.
Oh yeah.
Right?
If somebody can, well, that became a showcase, didn't it?
It's a showcase.
Yeah.
I share a studio with Mike Pick now. Mike Pick and Tim Murtaugh. I love those guys, but how I I didn't discover him, but how I first got a whiff of, oh, there's this talented guy named Mike Pick, was I saw his amazing CSSN garden contribution, which was all under the earth, and it was completely unlike a web page. It was just gorgeous and illustrated and dense, and
it's so neat,
really amazing. Yeah.
What is Dribbble?
Dribbble is, well, you were talking about Dan Cederholm earlier. Dribbble with three B's, dribble.com, is a community of designers, web people, and developers too, but mostly designers. Yeah, you're looking at it now. And Dan Cederholm and his partner, their idea was, when you're working on stuff, it can be kind of lonely, especially there's a lot of freelancers, a lot of people working out of their own apartments and whatnot. And he thought it would be nice for people to share work. But there are ethics about that. You can't just say, hey, I'm thinking of doing this for my client. Here's a complete layout in their copy. What do you think? Right? But you can show 400 by 300 pixels. You can show like a piece of an interface that you're working on. And in so doing, you can show someone, you know, they can get a sense of the texture you're going for, or a color scheme, or, you know, a photo treatment or something. So you can convey, it's like a perfume. You can convey a little essence of what you're working on. And other designers can comment on it. And it's the kind of community that has grown through recommendations. You can't just join. Someone has to recommend you. Everyone who's there can recommend up to five people. It's, you know, some people will attack it and say it's clubby, but what Dan and his partner have been able to do is manage the growth of their community in a nice way, manage the scaling up of it while keeping the integrity, keeping it, you know, what it is.
We're talking to Jeffrey Zeldman, legend in the web design business. Is eZine, which was started in the, 98, A List Apart is a must-read for every web designer out there. And, of course, he's a proponent of web standards. I want to kind of maybe talk about the present a little bit. What is the state, in your opinion, what is the state of web standards today? How are we doing?
It's really interesting because, on the one hand, I mean, on the one hand, standard semantic HTML and CSS, and JavaScript allow you to do amazing stuff that reaches people, all kinds of devices, especially with if you take a responsive web design approach, you can create a site or an application that works, that sort of conforms itself to the device, whether it's an...
This is the new hot thing, right, is this responsive
design. It is. I can't believe how successful and popular it's been. And Ethan Marcotte, the creator, very humble guy, seems to have no idea. He's just started this world revolution. I mean, I remember fighting for web standards for like a decade and having, you know, seeing very little traction it was really hard to get business people interested. It was hard to get all kinds of people interested in it, and responsive people who don't know anything about the web. They don't know what browsers are. Are excited about responsive. They get it. They get that my content can reach people on all these things in their pockets, the personal computer in their pocket, the personal computer on their lap when they're sitting on the couch, the traditional personal computer, the laptop, whatever. They get that. So on the other hand, the same multi-device world that we're working in is very frustrating and complicated. There are 500 standard Android configurations. There are two different definitions of a pixel in some Android devices. And I mean,
that is a problem.
in a way, it makes this responsive, device agnostic approach even more compelling, because you really, if you design with pixels and say, well, I'm going to make, you know, if you design for all the viewports that are out there, there's thousands of them. You can't do it.
Right.
You know, when there was an iPhone and one Android device and no iPad and, you know, and the desktop, you could sort of, if you wanted to, you could say, okay, I know what my fixed canvases are. But it's really, there's a tremendous energy right now and a lot of rethinking. The other thing that's interesting to me is that, and this is not my original thinking at all, a lot of people, Karen McGrain, Luke Rubluski, a lot of people, really smart people, are talking about this. To me and to them, mobile and all this kind of forces you, excuse me, to focus on content, the content that people actually came for.
Oh, shocking, really.
Because... With limited screen real estate, right, you can't fill up your page with junk.
Right.
We're used to, as per, you know, at Happy Cog, any design studio, you go to the client and there's always some turf war involved, right? So let's say you're working on a university's website. There's 15 departments and each of them wants to be on the homepage and they all want flyout menus and... Everybody, you know, and it's like that XKCD comic with what people are looking for on, you know that one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So you're always sort of fighting to try to put, you know, can we please have a little less of this stuff that nobody cares about and a little more of the stuff the user came for, but we'll hide the stuff the user came for. I have a demonstration on Roger Ebert's website, which I love. I love Roger Ebert. He's a great writer, great movie reviewer, but something like 1/16 of the page is devoted to his writing, and the rest of it is all this junk that, you know, the people who own the newspaper,
right,
all this irrelevant stuff. And that's standard now. We've, with all our sidebars and with our delusions that, well, everyone has 1600 by 900 now, so we can just fill it up with more and more and more junk. All of a sudden, we've got like a 300 pixel wide canvas. And what that does... Right.
Things on the front page of a university website, things that people go to the site looking for, and the only intersection of those two sets is the full name of the school.
Exactly. I love that. But that's been the history of web design over, you know, on the desktop in the last 10 years. And now with mobile, you can, you know, maybe fit the full name of the school on the screen. So you actually have to go to what people want. Because you don't have real estate. There's Luke Rubluski does this beautiful demonstration of Southwest's website, you know, on a phone where it says, you know, is my flight on time? Book a flight? You know, a couple of buttons like that that let you do the things that you actually came to their website to do. And then when you went to their desktop website, it was like flash movies with our exciting partners and, you know, theme songs and contests and all. You know, because someone in marketing figured out they could make money by partnering with this one and that one. And you understand why all this stuff happens and makes sense. Someone's got to find a way to pay for all this. That makes sense. But, you know, but with mobile, there's this, it's forcing you to
content, function, these things.
Usability.
Usability. They're now, it's interesting, because I think these, by the way, if you go to Zeldman.com, Jeffrey's website, perfect example of beautiful content focused big text, you know, it's great. I think of Om Malik's personal site, om.co, which was the first, I think, responsive design I was aware of. And it's just, it focuses on the content, but it's no less beautiful. Yeah. It's no
right.
less gorgeous. But I do wonder when you know, if you design for the small screen, do you lose out on the big screen? Or is this really what people want everywhere?
That's the theory, the content first theory. So, the contest first theory is if, and I first heard Jeremy Keith articulate this, right, who's a really brilliant British guy. He said, you know, so the theory is people want all this junk on the desktop. And, you know, no, people want, the context is different. The mobile context versus the desktop context is different. But in every case, people really want the content they want. I go to Roger Ebert's website to read his stuff.
Right.
So that other stuff should be kept to a minimum. If you're really smart, you can perhaps tuck away two or three things. This site looks like readability. It's very influenced
Isn't
by the
gorgeous?
Design of
yes,
readability.
You can tell.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as is mine. Right.
As it should be. And in readability, which
was a tool that people used to clean up these crappy sites so you could actually read them, was created because users wanted that, right? This is what they wanted.
Right.
They actually had to develop a tool to take the crap off of websites. Yeah. And yet, every website, and ours included, you have conflicting needs because we also need to show you banner ads, and we want to somehow find a way to show you all the content we have, all discoverability, all this. It's a very great challenge. Do you think
it
is
a great challenge?
Do you think this is what Microsoft has been influenced by with Metro? Metro is stark.
What I think is brilliant about Metro is, and is superior to. I mean, with the iPhone, I look and I see a bunch of buttons, which I love, right? But I see. I see the icons of the apps that I'm going to use.
Right.
But with Metro, I see, oh, there's a picture from my cousin.
There's actual content.
I'll open it. There's content. Right. Again, it's content first. It's visual, not verbal. It's this, but it's the same thing. Content first. It's a content-focused interface, which I think is amazing and wonderful. I think a lot of more. We're going to see more of that.
They also have eliminated rounded corners, drop shadows, skeuomorphic design, all the things. All the cruft that we accumulated over the years as good design. What do you think of all the leather and the stitching that Apple's putting into OS X, for instance?
Their theory is that it helps people understand what they're dealing with. And, you know, some of the things that they do, it's fairly successful. Other things are kind of horrible. I was opposed to it for a really long time. And this may just make me a bitter old man, but I had a hard time when Apple switched from Classic to OS X. It took me about 5 years to stop hating OS X and actually appreciate it for what it is and love it. But at first I was like, wow, so wait, so I need a lot more memory now so I can see all these drop shadows. I wonder
what this little remnant residual page that I've supposedly torn off on the calendar does to help me in any way.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess it's. I don't even want to say it's pretty. It's,
I don't want to say it's a fad.
It's a fad.
Remember, this is Spinal Tap. the driver is a big Frank Sinatra fan, and he's talking about Frank, and the band rudely, like, they raise the window so they don't have to hear him, and he turns to. He turns to the phone and he says, I don't want to say that, but this is a fad.
This rock and roll thing. That was Bruno Kirby. That's right.
Yeah, Bruno Kirby.
It's rock and roll. But you got to admit, designers are very influenced by trends and fashion and style.
Sure.
And there are, and it's really interesting. I think we are.
A lot of designers hate the skeuomorphic stuff. I mean,
I agree. Make jokes about it. And that's why I think I have to think that Microsoft, the designers in Microsoft, are saying there's going to be a backlash and we are going to create the cleanest, simplest, and I'm not just talking about you. It sounds like when you're talking about Metro, you're talking about it on the phone, but even on the desktop with Windows 8.
They're going to look modern.
It's going to look modern because it's clean.
Right.
But then there's the pendulum swings, does it not?
Sure. Sure it does. Yeah. Yeah, I always think that style is, you have to do something that indicates you know what time you're in, but you don't want to overdo it. Alfred Hitchcock was actually brilliant at this, the filmmaker. He would costume his people as timelessly as he could so that when an audience in 1960, whatever, watched North by Northwest, they didn't say, why are people wearing these strange clothes? But they also, and you look at some old movies and the clothes look funny, the hats and everything. Mm-hmm. They're very much of their time and it dates them and makes it harder to relate to the people. Like, oh, wow. So that's what Grandpa thought was hot.
Oh, you look at Michael Douglas in Wall Street.
Right, there you go.
Versus Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window. And that's it's very interesting. Yes. I never knew that, Jeffrey, but you're absolutely right. There's a timeless quality. And
so, it was of its time, but he really understated that. So yeah. I think that's a good design principle. If you can do little things that reflect, I know it's 2012, but not go overboard.
Perhaps it's because Hitchcock, with the huge ego, believed and knew that his films were timeless and would last beyond him.
Designers
probably figure out, we're just doing, this is ephemera. This is trivia. This will be gone in a year anyway.
Well, it is. I mean, when I think about architecture, right, I think about the courage it takes to make a building.
No kidding.
people are going to be stuck with that for maybe several hundred years.
No kidding.
And if it's bad, if I make a terrible website, I mean, it's serious. It could have serious repercussions for the client and their business. So I have to take it seriously.
But not for long.
At the same time, the skin of it, right. Ultimately, so, you know, when we redesigned at Happy Cog, when we redesigned WordPress, like 2 months later, it was redesigned again.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's just the nature of it. So you take your best shot and it's, you know, the web is never finished. That's kind of the great thing about it. And it's a wonderful playground for ideas because you can keep experimenting and you can fail a lot and still, I mean, I'm proof of that. You can fail a lot and still be considered successful.
I do see that designers get very much influenced by other designers and they are become trends. And now they're, and I'm just looking at WordPress.com and it reminds me of Pinterest. There is the Pinterest look now, the squares with the, with the things and the, and I guess in some ways this is also
so WordPress content. WordPress has looked like that for a while.
That's
actually
true.
So
that's true.
So that
maybe Pinterest is copying them.
I just sometimes there's things in the air, don't you think?
Yes, a time, an idea whose time has come.
Pinterest in a way is like Metro.
Well, that's exactly what I'm thinking, that there is this thing, squares and no and it almost feels like a reaction to the rounded corner. We got so into rounded corners, it's like, God, no more rounded corners.
Well, now we actually, now we can do them in CSS.
I know.
Right? We spent 10 years. People used to write articles about this. You
know? I remember. I think Danny Cederholm, I remember very well reading an article on how to make a rounded corner. It was a lot of work.
Doug Bowman had a brilliant way of making a rounded corner, you know, what was it called? Sliding doors.
That was him.
It was mostly semantic. It was mostly semantic, right?
Mostly.
There were just like 8 extra divs or something like that. But, you know, we were all very happy. And now that the CSS supports it, it'll go away.
Let's talk about JavaScript. What's your opinion on that?
It is a wonderful, necessary, standardized tool for adding behavior to websites. And the trick with JavaScript, like with everything else, is I'm a big proponent of progressive enhancement, which means you make a site, you make or an app, you make something that works in any device that understands HTML. So even if you're going to have really fancy, you know, JavaScript for people using modern browsers or what have you, there's a basic version that is just, you know, that uses forms.
Right.
So it'll work on a Newton. Right?
No, you're right. TR, TD, the Newton understood.
We have a friend who, Splorp, who every time we do something, he sends it to us on a Newton. Here's how it looks on my Newton. Good work, guys.
They're out there.
He knows he's a collector. He knows it's an archaic.
But I think it's interesting because he's saying, look, it's got to look good on the most primitive platform and look better, of course.
If it works on something, right, and it's a decent experience on a platform that was discontinued 10 years ago, then you're doing something right. So you build up from there with progressive enhancement, right? So ultimately, with JavaScript, you can have all kinds of carousel effects and things opening and closing and changing shape and all that. You can get into the same silly territory we got into with Flash.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of that. I think simpler is better. I think, because again, I think good design is somewhat unobtrusive and it lets the right user find the content they came to find at the right time and do what they came to do. So, I like a little sex in my interface too. You know, we all do. So JavaScript can be overdone. But regardless, I think responsibility is the bottom line. Even if you have some elaborate JavaScript construction for the person with the, you know, high, you know, fast bandwidth and, you know, modern browser on a desktop, still you start with progressive enhancement. You start with that baseline experience that works for anyone. And I think with mobile, where again, we have to think carefully about everything that we do. We have to think about
even the new. Here's Splorp's slideshow of HTML5 on Newton, by the way.
Go.
God bless right? him.
Right? It's amazing, right?
It's amazing. This is Apple. Apple's actually doing a good job.
And this is the Apple homepage?
Yeah.
Because it's semantics. There's semantic markup.
It's semantic markup. And that's why when you ask what is, when people in the chat room say, well, semantic, what does that mean? And why is that important? That's why it's important.
It's too bad that it has that name because there's something.
It's a terrible name.
It's very academic sounding.
Yeah.
And then there's.
But are you glad Flash is dead?
I don't know that it's dead. I'll tell you. I guess, a little. I felt like an idiot in the 90s when my friends were designing much cooler looking stuff than I was. And I was going, no, HTML, CSS stuff, they're gonna make it work in the browser. Look, I know I can't really control the spacing, but it's going to get better. I felt like I had bet on the wrong horse, and
but
I was
God
alone.
Bless you, you didn't give up, did you?
Too stupid to give up. Too dumb to quit. And
you didn't go learn action script or whatever the hell it was called. You didn't.
I found it really difficult. I would do it when a client required. I mean, what Happy Cut was originally just me. So when it was just right. me, I had to do everything. And I had Hellman Curtis's book open, you know, on my desk going, okay. Yep. But I would do 14 hours to make some letters move. Right? It was 14 hours of labor to make. And it was a nice effect. The letters kind of came on and it was pretty. And I'm sure, you know, Josh Davis was doing brilliant stuff with Flash, and now he's doing it in HTML5. But he was an artist. He's really a fine artist. He has stuff on you know, he's a really brilliant guy. There were definitely mad Owens. There were some really great studios doing amazing stuff. I just felt dumb and like I was using bad tools. But the tools got a lot better, and the stuff we're doing now is really amazing. And, you know, I look at it, We just put together a carousel, and it was all this animation and everything is just CSS. There's almost no JavaScript, and on, you know, if someone's using IE8, they get all the content. They just don't have this nice smooth glide up and down, and they don't miss it because they, you know, nothing does it smooth up and down glide for them, and it's okay.
Exactly, they're using IE8. It's,
one of the most important websites is. I always get the name, the URL, but the URL is something like, do websites need to look the same in every browser.com?
Do websites need to be experienced exactly this? This is a ridiculous, nope. The answer is simple. Do websites need to be experienced exactly the same in every browser.com?
This is by Dan Cederholm, and that nope answer looks different depending on which browser you're using.
Right. You can tell I'm using Safari. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. So I have to say that there are a lot of things in technology and life that make me despair for the future of mankind. But one thing that actually makes me positive and optimistic is HTML5 and the move to web standards. I actually feel like we're moving in the right direction.
I agree. And I think... And this doesn't mean that there isn't a place for native apps, because there definitely is, and there's some things they do much better. But the idea that there's this simple standard platform that's adapted, it's like the cockroach that will survive the nuclear war when we don't.
Yeah.
Its very simplicity means we don't know what devices are coming down the pike in 10 years or 5 years or 20 years, but we know that, you know, Project Gutenberg will still work. We know that all the stuff that we're publishing now, it will still work.
And there's really something to be said for that, whether it's Silverlight or Flash or any of these plugins. If it required that, that's guaranteed you're going to break something in 50 years. It's like saying, here, let's put it on a zip drive. That'll live forever. It's just not going to. But semantic markup, it's going to live. And that's so important. We're putting stuff online now that is our cultural heritage. It's our future. It's what people are going to want to read. We need to make sure that they can read it.
We still need to print it out.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know?
Yeah.
In case the...
Hard drives don't live forever.
I'll tell you, I was... For a while, I was sharing office space with a publishing startup, and the problem, and they had great technology, but the problem was the people running it, they were very experienced print publishers, and they didn't, so they would look at their magazine in printouts only. They were making something that was designed to work in iPads, phones, netbooks. That's what it was for.
Right.
And it was using this technology to create a magazine experience, right, but just using HTML, CSS, and JavaScript.
We see right? so no much proprietary. Of that. There's a ton of that out there. Yeah.
And then they would print it and look at it and go, I'm not sure this is working. And like, nobody's going to see it like that. They're going to see it on a screen. And you know what? They're going to turn the screen sideways and something's going to happen. Are you prepared for that? They didn't know. So, yeah, there's definitely. Go
ahead.
Go ahead. Sometimes you think like, well, racism will only ever really end when all the racists die, and or like, you know,
we're all one gray blob.
Right. So it's kind of like, you know, we're the last of the stupids. My 7-year-old is like is the future. Like those kids are growing up with this stuff. They understand touch interfaces. My dad's a brilliant guy. He's an engineer. He's very smart, but my dad has to go to the Apple store to take lessons on how to use a touch interface.
Yeah.
And
a 3-year-old gets it. A 3-year-old just uses it.
Right.
Your dad's mind was polluted by DOS.
Right. Exactly. He misses DOS. He misses the command line interface.
I need a batch file.
Yeah.
So let's talk about tools, because I know that everybody watching is saying, all right, well, what does the great Jeffrey Zeldman use when he does these amazing things? Tell me you're a Mac, PC?
Mac.
Are you paying attention to Retina? Does that matter to you?
We are as a studio. I'm not as a designer. I don't really. I think it's interesting that I think there's. Okay, so this is going to be a little bit more complicated of an answer. With responsive design, you want to send a small image that loads fast to a mobile device with a small screen, and you might want to send a larger image to a bigger screen, and you perhaps want to send a Retina quality image to a Retina quality device, but you don't want to go back to the old bad days of browser and device detection. That's just bad. You don't want to do that anymore.
No,
and
no JavaScript code saying what is your browser.
What are your browser? Agent? Because the user agents lie anyway. Opera says it's
they
IE,
do.
And you know, right? That's known. That's been known for years. Capability detection is good.
Okay.
Device detection is bad, but you can't always. You can't tell if someone's on. Oh, they're on 4G, so I can send them this.
Right.
But they have a real. Do they have a good 4G connection?
Right.
Are they about to go down to the edge network? There's so much you don't know.
Right.
This guy's on mobile, so he probably is in a hurry. Maybe, or maybe he's actually reading on his iPhone at home where he has very fast access. You don't know. So Apple, and I love them, but they do a very, I think, very stupid thing right now, which is that they are serving Retina images. Every image on their site is a Retina image.
Regardless of the device.
Regardless of the device. So that means when I load over my 3G AT&T connection on my phone, I have to, you know, and my phone is a Retina device, but you know what? I wouldn't really care. I will put up, I came up like blurring the background of JPEGs and, you know, going, you know what? The medium quality is good enough. And, you know, as long as the eyes and the teeth are in good focus, nobody's going to notice the rest. It's true. It's true.
Fact, sometimes we don't want to see the pores, really.
And we don't. Right. Okay. So you know about that, and Apple. I mean, I get why they have to do it, or they think they have to do it.
They're selling it. Come on.
But so this means that there's a whole lot of people having a, you know, waiting forever for an image whose advanced quality they can't.
Should
see
we it. Even as designers think about bandwidth consumption too? I mean, shouldn't we think about all the wasted bandwidth, or is bandwidth infinite?
Yeah. No,
cares?
Bandwidth is not infinite. I mean, as you know, it's a mobile world. Half the people are connecting on their mobile device at any given time to your site, and that means, you know, I have Verizon and AT&T accounts. I like both companies, but they can only do what they can do, and sometimes they get overloaded. I don't know if you remember the South by Southwest where nobody could connect.
Yes.
Right? It was a few years ago.
Yes,
and
I was there.
Okay.
The next year they had trucks in the parking lot.
Everyone had, right. Everyone had their new iPhones and they were all helplessly like, you know, like.
It's horrible.
Right? It was. Yeah. Okay. So and this is the thing on the, and you can't turn back time. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. You know, you couldn't make Flash go away when it came out, and you couldn't make designers go, you know, you couldn't say to a designer, you don't really want that type of graphic control, because the designer did want that type of graphic control. So the Retina is here. I don't know how many devices and Android devices have had that capability before. They just didn't market it right. They didn't call it Retina. But it's not going to go away. So we have on the, like, this is a really, I mean, we're being torn in all directions right now. And this is why it's such an interesting, exciting, and challenging time. On the one hand, people are coming for content first, and they may have 5 seconds to look something up while they're standing in line at the grocery store over a 3G network that's only partially functional. And on the other hand, they may have a Retina device and they may want us, and you don't know. And it's very, you know, people, we talk about context, but it's a very fuzzy term still. You really don't know the context, the use context most of the time, and you don't know the capability context most of the time. So it's very challenging. How can you create a great experience for everyone? One of the things, I mean, if SVG.
Yeah, if we're scalable.
Yes, if SVG had really taken off and it was natively supported in browsers just the same way JPEGs are, then that would be, it wouldn't do for photographs, but it would help a lot, you know, if all my buttons.
Right.
A lot of things, we'll have questions, we'll talk about, should we wrap an extra span around something, even though it's not semantic, and then let CSS create that gradient so no one has to download that gradient background image? Or should we stick a gradient background image in there knowing that some people are going to have slow connections and on mobile, every HTTP call is another hit, another performance hit. So what do you do? Then there's no...
Wow, that's an interesting question.
Right, so it's all like that. That's a tiny detail, but everything's like that right now. It's really interesting. What I tried to do with my redesign at Zeldman.com was bypass all of it and just go, and literally go, I'm going to make one design that works for everybody.
And it's very text-heavy, which solves a lot of problems, because...
For me.
At least text scales, right?
And I
are you using Google Fonts? Are you using...
I'm using... Don't embarrass me now.
Is it one of these font systems where you load in the...
It's a type service. It's WebType.
WebType. Right? Okay, yeah.
Yes. WebType at WebType.com.
Yeah.
And I'm using their Franklin.
They predated Google Fonts, but it's the same idea.
There's Typekit, there's WebType, there's several FontDeck. There's several really good services. You can also do it yourself. I like WebType's Franklin, and I'm actually serving it myself.
And you know what I love? Yeah. And maybe it's because you and I are old farts, but I love how big the text is.
Well, yeah, I hear that.
I'm sure people bitch that, oh my God, look at the size of that. But boy, I bet it looks great on mobile.
Well, when I get to be your age, Mr. Seldman, I'll appreciate this too, I guess. My dad likes it.
But you know, for years, the web was designed by 20-somethings, and everything was so small.
And now those guys are 40.
And so now they're suddenly getting big again.
Right. Totally.
But why? This is actually pretty large. Why did you choose that?
I went overboard. Okay, so I went overboard with the size. I actually think it's beautiful.
I love it.
I wanted to make the point that with Retina and with, you know, super high resolution displays and gigantic desktops and all this, the one thing we know that scales beautifully is type. Yep. And, you know, at Verdana and Georgia, right, the two Matthew Carter Microsoft types that are on everybody's system, they're beautiful big. They're beautiful big. And then if you pick one of those and pick a really nice typeface for your headlines, right, and, you know, and then you could actually create a pretty beautiful content experience that's a lot like, again, a lot like reading a book or like readability. I also wanted to make people sit back. So one of the things I love about my iPad, when I use an iPad, I feel like I'm more relaxed.
Yeah.
If I sit down at my laptop or my desktop, yeah, I'm working, man. I'm working.
Yeah.
If I sit on the couch and my kid's watching some kid movie and I'm sitting there with her pretending to watch with her, but I can sort of surreptitiously glance at my phone or my thing, I'm like relaxing and still, you know, answering emails. I read on the iPad and it's like reading a book, which I hold at arm's length.
Right.
And I squint at websites now, the way websites are designed, and my eyes are fine, well, aside from the glasses, but I have to lean forward. Things are set so that you have to squint and lean forward, and I don't like that. I want people to feel relaxed when they read my site. I want them to actually sit back and read it like they would with a book or a magazine or an iPad. Yeah. So I deliberately set the type bigger than it needs to be so that they would sit back.
Can I tell you how great this looks on a Nexus 7, for instance? Look how gorgeous that is.
Thank you.
That's just the right size. It's just gorgeous.
I removed everything. I mean,
I was going to say, there's no menus, there's no bar, there's nothing. It's just text.
If you go to the footer, I put some, you know, there's some navigational items.
Way,
at the bottom where they should be. I know. Right? But if you want to contact me or something like that, you can find
it. You could find it. And somebody in the chat room just said, oh, my God, I just realized this is the guy with the hat. Yes.
Yeah, I'm the guy.
With the hat. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't actually wear it in life that often.
Yeah, if you had worn that, Jeffrey, we'd all know who you are.
My 7-year-old daughter wears it every night.
Aww.
She wears it every night to sleep. This is not a marketing thing. Not my idea. She does it because she can't sleep without it.
It's her blue beanie.
It's daddy.
It's daddy.
She puts that on, and then I read to her. I know.
Oh, my God. Kids change it all, don't they?
Yeah.
It really gives everything.
Yeah.
What you thought you knew, you do not. I was going to ask you more questions. We were starting about tools, and I want to finish this. So what do you use? Do you use Firefox's debugger?
I use BBEdit and TextMate to write HTML.
Son of a...
And I want to try Coda.
Okay.
By Panic.
I love Coda, too. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful.
This is what I've heard.
But you know what? If you're a BBEdit guy, you know, I think that's a class apart, so to speak.
Do you know what I started with? Page Spinner. Did you ever hear of that even?
I remember Page Spinner, no.
Page Spinner was it still exists.
Before Dreamweaver?
Yeah, before Adobe bought Macromedia.
Learn and master HTML with the HTML editor. It is not only does it still exist, it's apparently not high DPI, I might say.
So it is this one guy in Sweden or someplace who makes this. And I really liked supporting him for a long time, but it's only one guy. He can't. I think when I couldn't have an HTML5 doc type, I said, okay, I give up.
Yeah.
I give up and I gave it. But what I liked about it, it separated the content from the code.
As it should be.
So, and it was actually in a different typeface, and the code was, you could change the colors and all that stuff. And I liked that. I kind of hate having everything be, and also it had little buttons like Microsoft Word, where you could just like, you could select all your paragraphs.
The toolbar, yeah.
You could select all your paragraphs and hit the little P button, and all of it, that would be done for you. And, you know, you can do that in WordPress, but you can't really do that in the tools that we use for serious coding. And that I don't know why. So, but you know, it's been about 5 years since I used Page Spinner. And God bless him, he's still doing it.
Now, knowing that you actually might like Coda a lot.
Yeah. Okay.
It's similar a little bit to that.
That sounds good.
Yeah. And the Coda 2 has a neat thing where you have an iPad and it renders the site on the iPad, so you almost have a dual screen experience. So you have Coda on your desktop and your iPad is rendering the page as you modify the CSS. So it's kind of an interesting way to do it.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
That sounds good. I use Fetch for FTP. I paid for Transmit. Everybody loves Transmit. It's great, but I couldn't let go of Fetch for some reason.
You liked the little running doggy.
Maybe that was it.
And
Xscope. Have you ever seen Xscope?
Xscope sounds familiar. I don't.
It's by Icon Factory, and it creates these little Icon tools Factory. These beautiful little tools. Like, I forget the width that I made something, but I turn on this little ruler and measure it, or I don't, you know.
Oh, yeah. See, I'm not a designer, so I wouldn't really need this, but I could see how this would be wonderful.
It's a great tool for designers. Yeah. And Photoshop, of course. And for writing, I've been using Clean Text lately. Hmm. Clean Text removes everything. It's like,
because why do you need it?
There's a lot
of...
Wait
a minute, this is a web tool? This tool?
For writing. Hmm. I don't know what Clean Text org is. I think that's different.
This is something else. Okay.
That's something completely different.
Clean Text for Mac. Like, oh, it's from API Mac. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
More
for me to download.
Twitterific, Evernote, Last.fm.
Do you put...
I listen to music all day long.
Do you put... ideas and stuff in Evernote? Do you use that as kind of repository for snippets?
Evernote and Simple Note. The thing about... I love Evernote, and it's amazing. The one thing I don't like is it's WYSIWYG type, and then it gets that wrong. So some of the fonts at the beginning, you know, you'll select it, and it'll say Arial, but something isn't really Arial, and you'll say, well, since there's a drop-down, and it says Arial, perhaps I could change it to Helvetica. No, you can't. There's a drop-down with one item. Yeah. A drop-down with one item. So the type, the font you're looking at, and then it's wrong. So when I get frustrated with that, I go to Simple Note, which is basically just text. And if I'm going to...
Simple Note is a Chrome plug-in as well as an app.
Yes.
And it's kind of
handy. It runs in the browser.
Came very close to replacing Evernote with Simple Note.
But you can't drag and drop photos into it like you can in Evernote and all that stuff. So I love them both. They're, you know, both essential.
Skype.
For podcasts. Font Explorer X Pro for type, although I'm trying to use fewer and fewer fonts, so I may end up just using the system. Yeah. I mean, the
fonts are a kind of bad habit.
Yeah, it can disguise your lack of ideas, like everything else, like drop shadows and color. Everything can disguise your lack of ideas. So, the more you can simplify it, the better.
Everything Helvetica,
and then you get sick of that.
I like this Franklin. I think this is a really nice font. Good choice. It's really beautiful.
David Berlow is the type genius behind WebType and other companies, and he recut every way to Franklin to better on the screen.
Holy cow!
That's what he does.
Wow!
He's a dangerous genius. He's just a brilliant guy.
I would love to do an hour with you on type alone.
That would be great. There are better people than me to do that.
Well, there are some wizards. We'll have to find some type wizards. It just hit me that we don't spend... People don't think about it a lot, and it's fascinating. It's actually very interesting.
It's half of design.
Yeah. Jeffrey, what a pleasure talking to you. You do a podcast, too. Tell me about that.
I do, Leo. So I do a thing called The Big Web Show. Well, it's been on a hiatus for a few weeks because just... Life has been crazy the last couple of weeks, but the Big Web Show we call it Everything Web That Matters, and I started it with Dan Benjamin and as my co-host, and now I just do it alone. But I interview people who are doing interesting things on the web, whether that means they've created an app or they've got an approach to design. You know, obviously Luke Rabluski on mobile first. Jeremy Keith on HTML5, Karen McGrain on responsive content or adapting ourselves to adaptive content. And I'm in a lucky position in that with Eric Meyer, I run this conference, an event apart. So I hear the best speakers and then I go, yeah, I should interview them on the show so everyone can hear that. Not everyone can come to the show, but everyone can hear the podcast. And then maybe some of those people should write books. So I've got this sort of ecosystem now where... The best speakers end up on being interviewed on the show. That's democracy. Or maybe they write for a list apart. That's free. That's democracy. And then maybe they come up with a book. And, you know, the books are you can read it, you know, you're flying from New York to Chicago, and by the time you land in Chicago, you know why, you know, why design is a job, or you understand how content strategy works, or whatever. Right. They're sort of deep dives, but very narrowly, very crisply focused on particular topics. And I try to have interviews that can do the same with people who are, you know, kind of maniacally obsessed with one, you know, how to make responsive images work, or whatever it happens to be. A lot of it, not so, it's less technical than Jen Simmons' show, I think. But
one last question. Favorite, sure. Favorite content management system?
Secretly, it's WordPress for me. For my personal
why,
use.
Why secretly? What's wrong? I mean, that's...
Well, corporately, we use Expression Engine a lot. So this is great. Expression Engine is very powerful. And we use Expression Engine for magazines and client sites. But for me, with my roots in writing and blogs and stuff, which I've been doing for a long time, WordPress is perfect. And WordPress is actually capable of doing all kinds of advanced stuff. They just don't do a... You can do e-commerce with WordPress. They just don't do a very good job of letting people know all the things they're capable of.
No, I actually very much like... we use Drupal for all of our sites and been very happy with it. But
yeah, Drupal's very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, what a pleasure, Jeffrey. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Leo.
Just really fun, interesting stuff. We'll have to do this again.
That would be lovely. Thank you very much, sir.
The guy in the blue beanie. I should introduce you that way right from the start. Then everybody would know. He's not wearing a hat. How do we know?
I love that. I love that that guy sat through the hour.
He did. He was listening. He was interested.
He didn't know who I was.
Oh, that's the guy in the blue beanie.
Yeah.
Do you want it? Is Blue Beanie Day ongoing? Is that still?
Yeah. In November, we'll do Blue Beanie Day again. It'll be the 6th.
And it's for web standards.
Yeah, you put on the blue beanie for web standards. Ridiculous.
It's, you know, it caught on. It did it. It worked. It did it. And I'll tell you when we'll have you on next is when they come up, and I know they will, with a replacement for SOPA, we'll get you back on to talk about
brilliant. Thanks very much,
sir. Thank you, Jeffrey. Take care. Zeldman.com. This show is all about great minds, great people, great thoughts, interesting conversations. We do triangulation every Wednesday. About 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC on twit.tv. I do love it when you watch live. As you can see, we pay attention to the chat room. We interact with the chat room, and it's very helpful. But if you can't watch live, on-demand versions are always available of everything we do, both audio and video. You'll find them on twit.tv, in this case, twit.tv/TRI. Or, of course, you know, the best thing to do is if you have a place that you subscribe to podcasts, like iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or Dog Catcher, Instacast, whatever it is that you do. If you would subscribe, I would be very grateful. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next Wednesday on Triangulation.